Good evening. This is Chris Robinson, and I'd like to welcome you all to this evening's project for Deeper Understanding. Tonight's forum is here at St. Luke's and is being broadcast live by KPCW in Summit and Wasatch Counties and is available online at kpcw.org. Tonight's broadcast is being sponsored by the Summit Land Conservancy, whom we thank very appreciatively. The topic for tonight's project for deeper understanding is the following: the Public Lands Initiative. Is it right for us? What is the Public Lands Initiative? Will it promote Utah's wilderness lands? Will it promote economic development? Who will win and who will lose? Can the right balance be found? We have a very august panelist of five gentlemen with us tonight. They are Cody Stewart, who is Governor Gary Herbert's policy director and energy advisor. We have David Garbett, who is a staff attorney with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. We have John Ruppel, who is at the S.J. Quinney School of Law and who specializes in public lands and natural resources issues. We have Casey Snyder, who is Representative Rob Bishop's legislative director. So to kick the evening off, I am going to ask each of you a few questions for which you will take 3 minutes to sort of set the stage. And we'll start with Cody Stewart, Snyder. We're starting with Casey Snyder. What is the PLI, Casey? Why did the congressman, meaning Representatives Bishop and Chaffetz, undertake it? What has been the process? And what is proposed briefly in the discussion draft of the bill?
Thank you. And again, my name is Casey Snyder. I am with Congressman Bishop's office. I must say before I begin, I feel sorry for the rest of my panelists this evening. I feel like I have home court advantage with a Snyder in Snyderville this evening. So I warn the rest of you that this is the home team here. It is me.
I think it's spelled differently.
The Public Lands Initiative represents, or at least as it exists now, represents an opportunity, a once-in-a-generational opportunity, a chance for the residents and counties and communities and industries of eastern Utah to finally find a way forward, to find a way through conflict, and to settle and resolve things that have kept us from moving forward in the past. It is the culmination of 3 years of hard work on the part of our office, Office of Congressman Chaffetz, Senator Lee, and many interest groups and industry folks and counties to see if there is a path forward where compromise can exist. What you see before you, or what have you seen before you in the press, represents 3 years of that process. Tens of thousands of miles have been traveled through the course of that endeavor. Hundreds, if not thousands, of meetings have been had. I personally have walked on nearly every inch, it seems like, of this country, hoping to see if there's a way that industry and wilderness, conservation and grazing, all these interests can exist in one sphere and move forward. The second week of January of this year, a draft was introduced. Again, the product of that endeavor that started so long ago. It exists very much as a draft, as a first chance to put pen and paper together to see how close we've come to solving these problems. You know, it's very much not written in stone. And even if it were, even Moses went up on the mountain twice before he got it right. So I suspect tonight you're going to hear a variety of opinions. I suspect that you will hear concerns and questions, all of them legitimate and real, because problems and questions do exist. But I assure you, it is the commitment of my boss and our office that we will work through these problems. If folks will continue to meet us at the table and meet us halfway, I am confident that we can resolve this conflict in that part of our state. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Casey. Would next like to hear from you, Cody, to explain how has the state been involved? What leadership role is Governor Herbert taking? How does the state view the discussion draft of the current proposal, and how does it relate to the transfer of public lands?
Thank you, Chris. That's a number of questions in a short period of time. Let me try to address as many as I can. First of all, thank you for the invitation to be here. It's a pleasure to be with you and with this great panel. To your first question, the state's involvement and Governor Herbert's involvement, you know, it could be said that we've been involved from day one. I'm a former Congressman Bishop staffer, full disclosure, and so I actually had some of these conversations with him a number of years ago before this process even started. So likewise, when I came to the governor's office, we were involved very, very early on, really from day one. In terms of our role, I think the governor has recognized that this is a piece of federal legislation, so it rightfully is being driven by Congressman Bishop and Congressman Chaffetz. I wouldn't say we've been backseat drivers, but hopefully we've been in the passenger seat and offering some helpful advice as we've gone through the process. I think the governor wanted to bring a statewide perspective to this. You know, we're talking about a number of counties, largely eastern and southern Utah, but the governor wanted to make sure that as we had the discussion, we weren't losing sight of the big picture, that there weren't anything here involved that would detract from other broader state goals or the governor's values and interests. You know, there's two things I really want to focus on tonight. First of all, there's two products from the Public Lands Initiative. The first one is this draft legislation, and it's critical that we emphasize that word draft. As Casey just alluded to, again, this isn't the final product, and that's important. I think it reflects a humility, a recognition that we're not done yet, that we still have work to go, and that there's actually a lot of work ahead. Most of the time in Congress, when they introduce bills, they attach an HR number to it, a House resolution. And when you do that, that does create kind of a sense of finality, or at least that, hey, we feel comfortable enough that we're going to introduce the bill, make it public, and run from there. But they didn't do that. They chose, I think, again, in a sign of humility, that they're going to introduce a draft piece of legislation, open to additional change. So that's point one, is that this draft bill, you know, Casey and David probably are more in a better position to talk about that. I want to focus my last minute on the process that it created. Through the Public Lands Initiative, it started a process, a bringing together of really not like-minded folks, people who come from different ideologies, different backgrounds, you know, even geographically, people from different parts of the country. And this process, I think, went a long way in creating a drive to reach consensus, something I haven't seen before. You know, it's interesting that somebody who's been involved in public lands issues for about 15 years, if you would have asked me 10 years ago, could you ever really be friends with the people from SUA? I would have laughed. I would have said, really? You know, SUA?
They've
I mean,
got you on the other side of the room.
Yeah, that's why they...
Leaving that to Casey.
But I can honestly say, after going through this process, that I see a number of the SUA staff as friends, people I like and respect. We don't always agree. We're not always going to agree. But this process brought us together. So, just to wrap up this portion again, I think that the process is critical, and to borrow an analogy that Casey alluded to, since we're in a church, maybe I can use a church reference. You know, there's a huge difference between Saul and Paul. The approach of Saul was someone to bring down, to criticize, to persecute, whereas Paul was somebody who was there to build up. Instead of trying to make his point, he was trying to make converts. Instead of trying to tear down, he was trying to build up. And I think that's what this PLI process has created, is a chance to do just that. And so my plea tonight is, let's don't give up on the process. We still have a long way to go. We still have a lot of work to do. But if we stay within this process, I think we're on the right track.
Hopefully we'll have a vision, as did Saul, come out with a little more enlightenment. That would be nice. David Garbett, it's your turn. What concerns does the environmental community have with the current proposal and the process that led to it? Are there positive elements to the proposal? How could the process be improved? And is there hope for reaching compromise and consensus? And David also has a handful of slides, which the listening audience will have to just imagine.
Chris, thank you. Thank you, everyone here at St. Luke's. And it's a pleasure to be up here with my fellow panelists. I was half expecting that Casey wouldn't show up, so I'm happy he's here as well. The environmental community has a number of concerns with this public lands initiative. I think that it could be best described, this bill, as a fossil fuel development bill. And the map for audience members here in attendance in St. Luke's up on the wall behind us illustrates that process or that fact. The large brown areas you see on the map total more than 2.5 million acres. There is no single designation in the Public Lands Initiative larger than this. And this designation would dedicate these lands to permanent fossil fuel development. If we can go to the next slide. For those listening, I'm showing a picture here of the San Juan River. This is an area that the Public Lands Initiative proposes as a fossil fuel zone and energy development. We'd like to see this protected as wilderness. We think this is a national treasure of a landscape, and unfortunately the PLI is currently draft doesn't recognize that. The next slide shows what the second component of this bill does, and that is to advance the efforts of the state of Utah's legislature's land grab. So this effort to deprive Americans of their management, their say, over our national public lands. One of the key ways that it does this is to grant to the state and county highways on dirt roads, dirt trails, two tracks, faint footpaths in the desert, again calling these 66-foot wide highways. And the next slide we have is a photo of one of the so-called highways that would be granted in this public lands initiative, so over 10,000 miles of routes. Now, in terms of wilderness protection, so what is there for conservation to offset this? Unfortunately, the wilderness designation in the bill would actually take us a step back. If the PLI passed, we would have less wilderness tomorrow than what the BLM is the Bureau of Land Management is managing today. So, as a whole, we're not very happy with the PLI and what we've seen. As to whether or not we think it's possible to resolve these concerns, that depends. In the state of Utah, we have a 20-year history of failed attempts at land conservation measures, and I think the root of that problem is a failure to recognize here in Utah that these lands are actually national lands, and everybody in the country has a say over how they're managed. The PLI has largely given decision-making authority to county officials. Now, Chris, there were some counties that did it right. Summit County, I think, is case in point, where the county brought together ranchers from Wyoming, environmentalists from Summit County, Salt Lake, and across the nation to reach a consensus proposal. But there were other counties like San Juan, which said, if you're not from our county, we don't care what you have to say. So any process where the person dictating that process is elected by fewer people than my high school student body president, that's not going to lead to a good outcome, and it's not going to represent the views of all Americans.
Thank you, David. Now, Juan, we'd like to hear from you. Did I skip over my introduction of you? I did, didn't I? Juan is the former state director of the BLM in Utah, and now is the director of HO, which stands for Hispanics Enjoying Camping, Hunting, and the Outdoors. And we're especially pleased to have Juan with us because he has a storied career as a federal land manager. And so, Juan, what are your observations as an experienced land manager on the need for the PLI? What portions of the process have gone well and what not? And on what and what is needed to make it successful?
Well, thank you, Chris, and thank you to my panelists and to all of you in the audience and those on the listening radio. Thank you. You know, I'm super excited today because at 1:30 this morning, I got a call that my eighth grandchild was being born in Price, Utah, and that's why we're having these conversations, because all of us really have generations that come after us, and that's who we need to speak for. Those generations that come after us. And so my commitment is that. Let me do a full disclaimer that I do not speak for the BLM, nor the Forest Service, nor any of the agencies. I am simply Citizen Juan Palma that wants to speak for public lands. That's all. I don't represent any of these other entities. I do have some experience as a practitioner of all of these laws and all of these things that we're going to talk about tonight. This is not an esoteric, philosophical conversation. I've actually done it for the last 30-plus years. So that's what I bring to the table. So why do we need a PLI? I think we need a PLI because since the inception of our country, the President of the United States, all presidents, and Congresses have been involved in public lands from the inception. In 1783, when Adams finally negotiated the Treaty of Paris, and we actually got the lands west of the Ohio River Valley up to the Wisconsin area. You know, there was a great conversation amongst those at that time, Jefferson and others, as to how we would dispose of those properties. The conversation ended at that it was agreed as to how. We'll talk about it later tonight, how. But all the way through Lincoln, when there was a great discussion about bringing some of those lands and a discussion whether they would be free states or slave states, and there was conversations on Teddy Roosevelt as the progressives began to set some of those lands aside as Yellowstone and Yosemite and other parks, and all the way to all of the presidents to today, they have been involved in these discussions of public lands. That's the appropriate conversation that we need to have, and PLI, I think, takes it into that realm. This discussion, I think, is about opening up the conversation. My suggestions that I would say to the Public Lands Initiative is that thus far the conversation has been sort of open for a while to all of us, then all of a sudden it's closed, then all of a sudden it's open. My suggestion to improve the process that others have talked about thus far is that we need to have a more facilitative process. People that are not as much invested. A university would be a good way. From many comes one, is a university. So I think a university can play a key role to facilitate the next steps of PLI. That's what I would recommend that we do into the future.
Thank you, Juan. And now, John Ruppel, if we could have you give us your opinions on how the PLI may resolve some long-standing disputes and the litigation over public lands, what you view the relationship between the PLI, the Utah Transfer of Public Lands Act, and the Antiquities Act is, what that relationship is all about. So if you would take 3 minutes and do that. It's a tall order in 3 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. That's a lot to cover in 3 minutes. But first, let me thank St. Luke's and to my panelists here, co-panelists, and to everybody that turned out today. I really appreciate you being here and the invitation to present as well. So I'm going to summarize those three different processes really briefly. The Transfer Public Lands Act, if you're not familiar with it, that's the state bill that was enacted in 2012 that demands the federal government convey title to over 31 million acres of federal lands to the state. And the state, as you're probably aware, is threatening to move forward with litigation if the federal government doesn't proceed down that road. In my opinion, the frustration that's driving that effort is sincere, it's heartfelt, it taps into some real tangible problems with our public lands, but the response to that is not well thought out, that it lacks legal merit and it's likely to fail. The other problem I would point out with the Transfer of Public Lands Act is if the state did succeed in taking over those lands, in order to cover management costs, we would have to see a significant change in management planning in order to increase that revenue. Now, contrasting that to the Antiquities Act, the Antiquities Act was passed by Congress in 1906. It gives the president the authority to protect lands that have scientific or historic value. In the last 110 years, 15 of the last 19 presidents have used that authority to protect lands such as the Grand Canyon and Arches National Park. So there's a strong precedent for that. But the key point with respect to national monuments is the president has very broad discretion in what he can declare in that monument and in setting very broad management requirements. We've seen that play out over the last couple of years with proclamations that recognize valid existing rights, state authority over wildlife management, state authority over permitting water rights, and a number of other similar areas. But more importantly, it's the start of a process, not an end of the process. So if there is a monument designated, that would start a planning process that would have opportunities for public involvement. Now, comparing that to the Public Lands Initiative, I agree with my colleagues up here. I think it's a laudable effort. I think it's important that we're bringing the public together, we're getting broad input, and we're looking for ways to address the underlying causes of frustration over our public lands and our deep desire to care for those places that have connections to us on many levels, whether those be economic or otherwise. One of the challenges as we move forward is remembering that this is the Public Lands Initiative. And as David pointed out, public lands belong to all of us. You know, the Supreme Court has been very clear on this for more than a century, that public lands are held in trust for all Americans, and all Americans deserve a voice in that. So hopefully as we move forward, we'll see more opportunities for broader public involvement.
Thank you, John. So I'd like to ask a few questions. I'd first like to start with Casey Snyder. Casey, David Garbett mentioned that this was a fossil fuel development bill, some 2.6 million acres of lands that would be dedicated or somehow set aside or for energy development. Could you address that and the suggestion that it's a land grab by the state of Utah for our audience benefit? How, in what way is the state receiving lands either through CITLA or otherwise?
Great, thank you. You know, the ironic thing about David's comments with regards to that specific provision is I have heard just as vehemently the exact opposite argument being made, that we have done nothing for energy development, that we've done nothing for the future ability to develop fossil fuels. Now, both comments are probably right, and both comments are probably wrong. And I think what we have attempted to do, and what that one specific example showcases, is we're trying to strike a balance. You know, this particular bill does designate 4 million acres for conservation. And as David articulated, yes, there are areas that are prioritized for energy development. The ironic thing about that specifically is those areas were not identified by us, but rather were identified through planning processes that the BLM implemented. So what we have merely done through this bill is say there are areas that are currently available for oil and gas development, that leasing and production can occur on those places. We have gone ahead and taken that to the next step in saying these are prioritized, these should be streamlined in these areas. With regards to transfer, yes, there are lands that are transferred to the counties, to cities, to the state. But all of those lands that are transferred come with the string that they are for public purposes only. There is no provision or no parcel within this bill that is a giveaway to the state without regard for future public use or recreational opportunities. So, you know, I understand the concern. We'd love to see it in writing if you know, SUA or others would like to send us a letter. That's part of the process. That's why we're here. But I think all of this represents an attempt by our office to strike a balance, to wade through these very difficult and challenging issues and find a way forward.
So, David, with respect to the conservation areas or the wilderness, you indicated that there's actually a loss of wilderness. Are you referring to wilderness study areas that would no longer be managed as though they were wilderness? And how do you reconcile the need for economic development in some of these rural counties that have an economy that's based on commodity energy and things like that? And where do people fit into your calculus?
Yeah, good questions, Chris. First of all, the BLM right now has areas that they manage as if they were wilderness areas, and those are wilderness study areas and another area that they call natural areas. If you add those two together, they add up to more than the amount of land that would be designated as wilderness in the Public Lands Initiative. Conservation in general, I think that the delegation's been a little fast and loose with the term in the PLI. For example, one of the areas that they count towards their conservation total, part of the stated purpose of this area is to promote a commercial forest products industry, in other words, logging. I don't count that as conservation. I don't think most people do consider that as conservation. So we are talking about big figures here. It sounds impressive, but this is a lot of land, land that really hasn't been addressed by Congress, so it's naturally going to sound like a lot. But again, at the end of the day, there would be less land managed for wilderness protection than what we have today. In response to your other question, what do we think about development? What do we think is appropriate? In October 2014, conservationists, along with Representative Bishop, the governor, and Daggett County, announced an agreement that we had reached what was really the first agreement in what we hoped would be many in the Public Lands Initiative, where we found common ground with county officials, where they said, we're willing to accept conservation here, wilderness expansion in the Uintas, wilderness and conservation areas around the Green River. And we said, in turn, we'd like to see some development opportunities for you, ways for the county to increase its revenue base. And one of those was a transfer of a natural gas storage facility. I wish that I could tell you there's a happy ending to that, but what happened is that one of the county officials there decided he didn't like the deal. He thought it was too generous for conservation, didn't have the development that he wanted to see, so he essentially tanked the process. For me, what that shows is that, yes, we can reach consensus. We can reach agreement about what areas are appropriate for development, what areas are appropriate for conservation. But I don't think we've been able to have that sort of, we haven't been able to find that sort of agreement in these other counties or had that opportunity to do it.
Okay, thank you. So, Juan, David mentioned these highways 66 feet wide that the bill would grant to the counties. Could you explain the RS-2477 issue as you understand it and what the PLI in the current draft proposal would or wouldn't do, to the extent you know?
Yeah, that's a topic I spent a lot of hours on the topic of RS-2477. But before I answer that question, let me quickly cover a couple of points. One is that one of my concerns on the current working draft for oil and gas is, amongst probably other concerns, but mine is that it imposes a time limitation upon which the agencies would process permitting of oil and gas. And those limitations are very tight, and yet it continues to impose all of the laws and regulations that currently exist. That is an impossibility that we put in as managers under. It's already stressful enough, controversial enough for some of these managers to put on a arbitrary timeline under which they would process those. And if they don't, it automatically moves forward. And yet at the same time, they need to do the environmental work. Those are two at odds that we cannot have from my perspective. Number two is that I want to cover is that we have different missions from CITLA or other state lands. If you want to use that model, their model is highest return on investment. A piece of property, how can I get the highest return on investment? Our mission from the Bureau of Land Management or the BLM, or not ours because I'm not part of them anymore, but it is for them multiple use, for many uses on those lands. That's a vast difference on those two main purposes. To the question third of that Chris asked about RS-2477, that is where the state can claim or the counties can claim that some roads existed prior to 1976 and they were in use 10 years prior to 1976. And if they can prove up, then they could adjudicate that in a court of law that that road really is part of that county system or the road system. In order to arrive at that, we have done several litigations across the state. Some have been, I think, very productive. We use as models. I'll give you one example in Juab County where myself, the county commissioners, and others were able to work together with the environmental community to agree what roads they really needed and claim and which roads we didn't feel existed prior to 1976. A judge so order, and that current model and plan is legally in place in Juab County. We can follow that model. What the state is claiming, nearly 12,000 roads that they claim belong to the state through litigation, a couple of dozen litigations, I believe that there's a solution to that, and that if we were to sit down together, we can find a solution, especially what we call the B roads, which some are already paved roads. The D roads are a little more controversial, but I believe we can sit down and resolve some of those. Some of those D roads, when I look at on the ground, and I've been on as many roads as Casey has been, if not more. I travel a lot all over the state. We manage nearly 50% of the state of Utah under the BLM, and I can tell you, I put 20, 30,000 miles on my vehicle every year when I was with the BLM before. I know some of this country. I've been there. I've been to that road. I've been to that tree. I've been to that canyon. I've been to all these places. And I can tell you that some of these roads we can resolve. Some, obviously, probably cannot. Thank you.
Thank you, Juan. So, Cody, continuing that theme of the roads, they seem to have a pervasive influence on the process because if there's a road there, then it changes the wilderness characteristics or the natural characteristics of the property. What has the state of Utah been doing with respect to these roads? And do you agree with Juan that there is a way to negotiate, you know, to come up with a list of roads that, yes, you know, we'll designate these as appropriate roads and the others will relinquish our claim?
This is a tough question. As Juan alluded to, there is already existing litigation. The state has filed suit for thousands and thousands of these roads. I think the goal of the Public Lands Initiative with regard to RS-2477 was this a way to maybe help speed up that process and avoid the litigation? Can we actually resolve some of this through negotiation, discussion with the parties involved and not go through the courts, not spend all that time and money and effort in the legal process and resolve it through a political process? And if Congress deems these as roads, then the answer would be done and we wouldn't have to go through that process. So I think that the intent of including RS-2477 within the PLI was to do just that. If we have not reached that consensus point yet, I think there's still work to be done. But I think that most people would agree that's probably a preferable model than going through the route of litigation. To your first question, what has the state done? Over the last several years, again, there's historical timelines and certain facts have to be established on the ground. So the state has, for several years now, actually gone out and done interviews with people who live in these communities to ask them to get their eyewitness experience. You know, there's this road out here, you know, in 2 miles from town. What was it used for when you were growing up? And so they've actually been doing depositions for a number of years. One of the biggest challenges they faced is that a number of the people who have those recollections are passing away. Literally, they are dying. And the people who have that historical knowledge of that on-the-ground experience aren't with us very long. So the state is rushing to try to get as much of that actual eyewitness account on the record so that they can use that. Again, I think the preference for all of us would be to resolve this not in the courts but through a consensus negotiated process, but clearly we still have some work to do.
Thank you. So, John Ruppel, the very last title in the bill, and this is maybe a question for several of you, is called long-term land use certainty. In fact, the word certainty appears in many areas, trying to bring finite, once-and-for-all resolution to things. I believe that this provision is yet to be written, but that it has to do with the use of the Antiquities Act, the future use, if this bill were to pass, in these PLI counties. Can you address any of that, or do you have any sense for that?
Thanks, Chris. I think I'd need to defer to Casey on this. As you say, the last section of the bill talks about long-term land use certainty, but that section of the bill had not been included in the most recent draft. So I'd be speculating as to what that portion of the legislation would contain.
That's a fair yield of time to Casey.
I would do that same thing to David if I knew what he was going to say. It absolutely does. And part of that process is, look, what we're trying to say is we've gone through an extensive survey, an extensive inventory. We've negotiated these issues. We've beat them to death. And at the end of the day, it's neither fair to the people nor the process if, and on top of all the work that we've done, a monument designation could be overlaid. You know, and part of our concern with regards to this is this has happened before. You only have to look across the state line to the state of Nevada, to Lincoln County. And that county and those constituents negotiated an arduous process much similar to the one that we have just gone through and are going through with the PLI. They designated 750,000 or so acres for conservation, leaving that same amount, 750,000 acres, off the table for future conservation. That was the agreement. That was the negotiation. That was the give and take that made that whole deal work. Under this administration, the rest of that 750,000 acres was added to Lincoln County through conservation through a monument designation. Again, that's not fair to the people, and that's not fair to the process. So what we're saying is in these places where negotiations are had, where consensus has been reached, a deal's a deal. There cannot be 10 years from now, 5 years from now, 20 years from now, a monument designation coming that overlays all the work and eliminates all the good faith that was done and had.
So that all sounds good, except for it doesn't appear that there's consensus. I mean, David, how would you counter that? I mean, we see the bill, and it's obvious if any of you read the bill, it's 60-some-odd pages, and it's very detailed and has, you know, lots of little subparts dealing with specific pieces of real estate and what would take place. But it doesn't appear, in listening to you talk, that there's consensus on what should be set aside for wilderness, national conservation area, monument, special management area, nor what could be allowed for future energy development. Is there a way to have a meeting of the minds a la what you thought you had wrought in Daggett County, in these other seven counties? Of course, Summit, other six counties, because we're already there, I hope, in here in Summit. But
that's a great question. And I feel like it would be amiss if I didn't say at some point tonight, the way that the Public Lands Initiative started, the fact that Representative Bishop announced this effort to wade into this thorny topic, he deserves credit. And I hope that we have given him credit and publicly said, good for him in trying to resolve these issues. Now, somewhere along the way, we got off the rails. But what I think was encouraging is that the way the process started. I echo Cody's statements about, you know, I really respect Cody. I respect Casey, even if we're not seeing eye to eye on the bill right now. And I think that's the fundamental building block for eventually resolving some of these problems, some of these issues. Now, what I would say is that Representative Bishop, the one probably most responsible for shaping the Public Lands Initiative, for him, old habits die hard. It's a little hard to keep your hand out of the cookie jar. And when you see an opportunity to modify the way that wilderness is understood in the United States, when you see a way to do away with the president's authority under the Antiquities Act, sometimes it's a little hard to not just reach out and try and do that. And that's part of what's keeping us from reaching consensus. But if we could go back a few steps and not use the PLI as a statement to do things like promote fossil fuels or to promote the state of Utah's land grab, then I think there could be potential for consensus. And again, this may sound like a minor issue, but in so many of these rural areas, giving county commissioners the only say or the final say, or as Bishop would say, a veto over the process, means you will not reach consensus. You cannot reach consensus. Even talking to many of these county commissioners in places where they've said, you know, I understand what you're saying now. I didn't understand the issue. But when I run for re-election and I go to door, I'll be meeting with people that don't. And they'll say, how dare you accept wilderness? We thought that our county was a no-wilderness county. And they're really in a hard spot. And without having political cover, without Bishop telling them, you know, in the past we've tried this, it's never worked. We've never been able to pass a wilderness bill when county commissioners have driven the process. Without doing that, I just don't see us getting over this hurdle.
So I want to focus for a minute on the bears here. In the draft, the discussion draft, there is the creation of some 1.145 million acre Bears Ear National Conservation Area. Am I correct? And then there is the possibility of a Bears Ear National Monument that would be some 1,009,000 acres is the word on the street. Does the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance and the environmental community have as much interest in trying to make the PLI process work in the limited months remaining in President Obama's administration versus getting a win, I'll call it, by the declaration by the president of a Bears Ear National Monument? Is there really the will to roll up your sleeves? And this is a question really for anybody that's interested in this process, because it seems like the 800-pound gorilla in the room is that the clock's ticking, there's talk of a national monument, and what would happen, Cody, if there were one designated, or Casey, are the congressmen still up for trying to do something? Is that taking us beyond a point of no return? That's a lot of questions, but we're going to start with David, then maybe go to you, Cody, and then Casey.
Now, let me take the first crack, and then Casey and Cody can say Suez can't keep its hand out of the cookie jar. We like to take credit and say that a big part of the reason the Public Lands Initiative started is that Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance and our other conservation partners were proposing a large national monument surrounding Greater Canyonlands.
we wanted to see the president use his authority to complete the vision of Canyonlands and protect so many surrounding landscapes that I think when we visit the area, we naturally just think are part of the park, but they're not. Representative Bishop, again, I think wanting to address that and show the president, no, we can, Utahns can be trusted to resolve these issues with national lands, started the Public Lands Initiative. So it grew out of what I would say was the threat of a national monument, threat or promise of a national monument. We set aside those plans and said we would prefer to work on legislation. Legislation is the only way that we can get things like wilderness designation. As John alluded, presidential monument proclamations can be a little bit squishy. No side necessarily knows what it's getting out of a national monument. Now, as the Public Lands Initiative was moving forward, a coalition of tribes came up with what I think is a really exciting and remarkable proposal for protecting lands in the Bears Ears area. This is something that we endorse and we support. We had hoped to see the Public Lands Initiative address this and protect that area. But from the draft of the PLI, to me it's clear that that won't happen. And the way I describe this is what Representative Bishop has done with the Public Lands Initiative in the Bears Ears area is like showing up at a Tesla dealership and saying, I offer $10 for your car. It's not a place to start negotiations. That's a place to be laughed out of the room.
They first have to have a dealership, but yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
You have to get Rob Bishop.
So to me, that wasn't necessarily a real starting point for negotiations. President's not in office for much longer. I think the time now is for him to act. The delegation's had 3 years to resolve concerns with the tribe and to provide real and meaningful protection for the Bears Ears area. They haven't. Both of my slides, those photos were areas in the Bears Ears that are not protected under the PLI. So I think given the short amount of time the president has left in office, it's time for him to set aside a monument and we can work on the rest of the PLI.
Cody and then Casey.
Blunt, I think I would predict with some certainty that if a national monument is designated in the Bears Ears, the PLI goes away and any goodwill that has been fostered over the last few years disappears immediately. And here's why. Think about this. If you're negotiating with a partner and you work for years to actually reach an agreement, and you've reached that agreement, you sign the dotted line, you say, okay, we made it, we got there, and 2 months after you make the agreement, somebody comes in and says, you know what? Despite your agreement, we're going to do a completely different thing. We're going to ignore all your interests, and we're going to go with the person you negotiated with. That's what the situation these counties are in. We would have absolutely zero credibility to go to these counties and say, hey, work out a deal through the legislative process if they have the fear in the back of their mind that at any point in time, the president can overrule that and ignore exactly what they just negotiated. So I think Congressman Bishop, Congressman Chaffetz, and Senator Lee have been very clear that if there's a monument designated in Utah, we're done. We cannot negotiate any further. It's not because we don't want to. It's because there has to be no leverage for these communities. Why would they want to be involved in the process?
Yeah, but it seems to me that you use the analogy that the agreement's been signed and stuff, and that there's been consensus. It seems to me that there is wide disparity between the two sides right now. And is there really, you know, time is short. Is there really the desire and the will to come together, both sides, and try to come up with something where you could sign something and say, letter of intent, yeah, memorandum of understanding, yeah, we agree, let's run this piece of legislation.
I think the fact that we're here tonight, I mean, again, if we had given up, if we thought this was a fruitless cause, why would we be here? Why would we be here to spend time this evening to come talk about it? I think there is a desire to continue to move forward. Again, I'm not naive. I'm not going to tell you that it's easy and that we're right around the corner. But if you look at wilderness bills in the past, they take years. I mean, one county, you know, the Washington County Lands Bill took 5 to 7 years just for one county. And so this effort, you know, is tackling 7 or 8 counties. If it takes longer than 5 to 7 years, I wouldn't be surprised. Again, we hope not. You know, I would like to be involved when they actually finish it. So you're right. I'm not trying to pretend that we have consensus now, but I'm saying we're on that path. We've started that dialogue. We've entered, you know, a place where there is an element of trust, and I'm afraid that would be thrown out the window if a monument was designated in the middle of the process.
Casey Snyder.
Yeah, I'd like to echo what Cody has said, and I feel it's unfortunate. personally and professionally. My daughter actually was born in the middle of the PLI, and I'm sad to say I know PLI better than I know my daughter at this point. And all of that trust, all of that energy, all that effort goes away, not because we would like it to, but once something like that is broken in such a public and large way, scale way, there's no way to put it back together. You know, the other thing that I think everyone needs to step back from in terms of evaluating the landscape, PLI has issues, and it has concern. There are concerns on both sides that are valid, and it's why it's a draft. That's why we're working through that. That's why we're here. But there have been comments made by SUA within the last month or so where they have specifically said, we must take down PLI so that we can justify a monument. That's not me making those statements. That is nearly a verbatim quote from SUA. And so that makes it hard for us to move forward into the next round of negotiations when there is not this good faith effort that we had hoped and that we're attempting to facilitate and broker, but instead political shots and political motivations entering into this discussion. This bill, this PLI bill, is as large as 30 individual pieces of lands legislation. It's the largest lands bill ever conceived in the history of the state of Utah and one of the largest lands bills in the last 30 years in Congress. It takes time. And to rush that process is a disservice to the landscape and a disservice to the people who use these areas on both sides. We are committed to moving this forward, to doing it right, and to hearing people out. But if it's taken down for political purposes, there is no future for this effort.
Okay. Okay. Juan, please do.
This is a critical conversation, and I want to make one point to both the people here and the audience on the radio. And the point is this, that for too long, both Native Americans and Hispanics, we've been a little silent when it comes to public lands. And when we are more amplify our voices, when we speak about these topics, it's so that some people don't know what to do with us. But we know what we're talking about on this topic. In 1829, Armijo brought the first groups on the Old Spanish Trail along Moab, along the Emory County, down to Richfield. We've been around these lands long before Utah was the state of Utah. When Brigham Young came across on the canyon and said, this is the place was Mexico. It wasn't the United States until later. And so we have got to be part of these conversations. In Echo or Hispanics enjoying camping in the outdoors, we have 400,000 Latinos here in this state of Utah and many more in the other states. We have something to say about this conversation. Native Americans the same way. I think that we as we move forward, and I hope we are moving forward with PLI, we have got to bring Native Americans and Hispanics to this conversation. I don't know what they're going to do with us when we get to the table, but I can tell you we know the processes, we know the land, we know the history, and we cannot be left out of that. And I'm speaking for Native Americans right now. They cannot be left out of this process. They must have a voice at this table on this conversation, and they must be taken seriously on this topic. That is my point on this topic of bears' ears.
Thank you. So, John Ruppel, we've heard Casey Snyder and David Garbett discuss, you know, how difficult it is, how long it takes. Washington County's landfill took years. Casey's three-year-old child is unknown. All of those things. What is the process for a presidential proclamation of a monument? Would it be similar to the stealth approach of President Clinton in 1996, creating the Grand Staircase Escalante? Or would there apt to be more of an announced process where there would be hearings and public input? And how might that play out in the 9 months that remain in President Obama's term?
Well, when Congress enacted the Antiquities Act 110 years ago, they gave the president the discretion to designate new national monuments. They didn't require the president to come back to Congress and get approval. So it's up to the president to decide whether he wants to create a new national monument. He could prepare the proclamation and issue it tomorrow. That's within his discretion, and the courts have held that up. With respect to
how much time do these guys have to work something out?
I think that in part depends on the delegation. If a monument was designated, Congress has to make a choice, and our delegation has to make a choice whether they want to continue with the PLI, and that's something only that they can decide, and hopefully something that we can weigh in on as well and encourage them. But I do want to pick up on a comment you made about President Clinton and the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. The narrative often is that this was a monument that was sprung on people. It was a complete surprise. People were shocked. The reality is there were proposals to create national monuments in southeastern Utah that date back to the 1930s, that covered areas that are now considered as part of Bears Ears and covered areas that were then considered that are part of what is now the Grand Staircase that go back for decades. The federal government was well aware of Utah's interests and Utah's concerns at the time that President Clinton designated the monument. And the residents of Utah, and particularly southern Utah, were well aware of the possibility that a monument could be designated. So I think we have to be a little careful here and remember that we understand the processes that are underway, and I think the local residents know that a monument is a very real possibility. They may not agree on whether that is the best path forward or not, but I don't think this would be a surprise either way.
Thank you for that clarification, John. So in a moment or two, we're going to open this up to the audience for questions, but while I still have the floor, I just wanted to see if mainly Casey and David, if you could describe the sorts of compromises you might be willing to make in order to, I mean, we have hot buttons of RS-2477 road resolution across, blanket, just we're going to do it in the legislation. We have doing away with the powers of the Antiquity Act, future designations. We have the boundaries and the details on wilderness and on energy development areas. Is there any room for compromise?
Well, I'd like to let David go first so I can write down his answers.
Okay, I like that.
I wanted to go first. Again, I'm going to go back to Daggett County because in Daggett County we showed the sort of compromise that we could do. We had an agreement in Daggett County that resolved RS-2477 fights. We had an agreement in Daggett County where Sewell walked away from areas that we had been proposing for wilderness in our landmark piece of legislation, America's Red Rock Wilderness Act. We agreed that we could see ways for the county to acquire, like I talked about, a natural gas storage facility and for the potential future development of a ski resort. So on our side, there were some pretty hard compromises. I heard a lot of people say, why would you ever agree to things like that? But again, I think we showed that in context and given the opportunity to have a real negotiation and to be able to pick up conservation in exchange for things like RS-2477 rights of way, we could reach compromise and consensus. And I think you saw that here too, Chris, in Summit County, where conservation community walked away from areas that we had wanted to see expanded as wilderness. I'm interested to hear what it is that the delegation's willing to change in terms of their proposal for the sake of compromise.
I'm going to insert a minor comment that you use the past tense in Daggett County and Summit, and the question is, are you willing now, or are you beyond a point of no return in terms of coming to the table and working out the other six counties?
That's a great question, and there's a two-part answer to that. For San Juan County, and I want to go back since Casey said that we have said we're not willing to work in San Juan County anymore. Our position is as I described it. We've worked for 3 years with the delegation to try and resolve issues. And not just us, but this tribal coalition that I talked about, this Native American voice that has been asking for public protection. And what we've received in San Juan County is, as I said, a county that said, if you're not from San Juan County, don't come here. Don't give me your comments. I won't listen. I don't care. That's not a public process. Representative Chaffetz, when I asked him specifically about this, what is your idea of a public process for San Juan County? He said, any of you are welcome to drive down to Blanding or Monticello, where then no one would listen to us. That is not a public process. For 3 years, they've never been engaged in a real public process in San Juan County. This is simply an attempt to wait out the clock and not resolve the issue themselves or not allow President Obama to resolve the issue. The tribes have an amazing proposal. Their voice should be heard. President Obama has said, I want to serve underserved communities. This is a very interesting proposal for him, and I think he should act. The delegation has known about this. We've been talking about Bears Ears for years. This is not a stealth proposal. This is nothing like Grand Staircase Escalante. So in the case of San Juan County, no, I think they've missed the boat. In terms of the rest of the counties, if they come forward and show that unlike San Juan County, there is a willingness to have a real discussion, they're not coming in the door offering $10 for a Tesla, then yes, I think that in the future we could have these discussions. And my hope is that now as this process plays out, we'll get a Bears Ears National Monument. And that the next step will be that some of these counties will wake up and say, maybe we need to compromise a little bit more, and maybe we need to recognize these are national landscapes, and we won't get everything we want. Speaking of Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, that was the lesson that Emory County drew from that monument. Within 2 years, they had put together a proposal for a wilderness bill in Congress. It was inadequate, but they realized the only way to prevent monuments was to put together proposals addressing these unresolved issues on public lands. So that's my hope for
how
this will play out.
Casey, the last word before we turn you over to the wolves.
I'm sure David will protect me. I get the sense after this forum that he's on my side. I think to push back on David a little bit, to say the San Juan County portion of the PLI was not open or fair or adequate is a disservice to 3 years of work and a disservice to the county. When PLI started, the San Juan County Commissioner specifically said, not an acre, not a single acre of wilderness in this county. That will never happen, no way. Through a process that did involve multiple stakeholders, they came up with a proposal. And in the proposal that San Juan County put forward, there were over 600,000 acres proposed for some form of conservation. We've also weighed into this process and heard the concerns of tribes, the concerns of the environmental community, and the concerns of others. And in the draft PLI, the area known as the Bears Ears is conserved to the tune of 1.1 million acres, as you mentioned. So that was our attempt to split a very controversial baby. The county at 600,000 acres, a coalition at 1.9. 1.1 is pretty close to the middle, which is what this process is about. Now, moving forward, we are committed. We're committed to seeing this through. And to say that the PLI is just an attempt to run out the clock is wholly unfair. There are other ways that we could operate that are easier and less politically damaging to the people and to our bosses that we represent than working on the largest wilderness bill ever undertaken in the history of the state of Utah. We want to see this work because there is a genuine concern to solve these problems. Conflict is benefiting no one. SUA in these counties has not achieved a single acre of designated wilderness. There is no certainty on a single acre that they cherish because there is no congressional act that protects it or designates it as wilderness. If you're on the economic side, it depends on who's in the White House as to what the food on your children's plate's going to look like and what your economic future looks like. That is not fair to that side of the spectrum. We want to solve these problems. We are willing to move forward, and proof of that, I hope, is this process. The bill, in its draft form, is available online. The maps, every inch of it is online, and you can zoom in as close or as far as you want. We've had thousands of meetings and traveled thousands of miles because we want this to be fair. I think regardless of where this shakes out, I will be proud that this is how legislation was done, because people had a say, people were at the table, and hopefully people were heard. So, you know, we're here, we're willing to work. I am here, I'm willing to work. Let's move forward, and hopefully David's willing to work too.
Thank you. For those listening to this live broadcast, this is KPCW Park City.